Hello, Heather Knight. And as you can tell by that wonderful organ music, welcome to our Castro Theater episode.
Why, thank you very much.
So first question, on a scale of 1 to 10, how freaked out are you about the future of the Castro, which will be changing its programming when it comes back in 2023?
I'm not super freaked out. I think we've gotten some assurances since the news broke that, you know, some things will stay the same. Most importantly, in my mind, the organ. So I'm going to say a 5.
A 5? I'm about a 4.5 right now. We're on the same wavelength. But I was an 8. The Castro Theater means a lot to me and a lot of San Franciscans, and I know you as well. It was bought by the Nassar family in 1922, still owned by the Nassars, but there's some big changes coming. Another Planet Entertainment, which is a local company but has some corporate sway, will take over. And what they do with the venue remains to be seen. So we called our friend, Chronicle Arts and Culture columnist Tony Bravo, to talk us down and pay tribute to the Castro. You live in San Francisco. I have deep family roots in the city. Tony has both. He's like the best of both of us, Heather.
Yes, Tony is great. He's one of the coworkers I miss the most. He's just always so funny. Got a little snark to him, and it's always great to chat. So I'm glad we use this as an excuse to connect with him.
Definitely. We're going to talk about what's going on with the Castro with Tony, and we're also going to share some of our favorite memories. Tony's grandmother gets involved, and I really want to meet her. She sounds awesome. Tony's also working on a story about the Castro. Look for all of his stories and columns in our datebook section at the Chronicle. I'm Peter Hartlob, here with Heather Knight. We can't wait to hear that organ again, and this is Total SF.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to Total SF, Tony Bravo. You're one of the people we miss seeing and talking to in the newsroom, and I am looking forward to a brighter future where we can do that again. But right now we are on a Zoom call, hoping construction noise and my dog don't interrupt this.
Hey, Peter. Hey, Heather. Thank you so much for having me, and I miss seeing you both at the 901.
Well, hopefully we'll be back there soon.
Yeah, so we're here to talk about the Castro, little tribute to the Castro. But first of all, I want to establish you. You're a San Francisco native. I don't like doing the, like, who's got the most generations, but I think you have fourth generation.
Yeah, four generations through my mother's family, through her mother. Born in San Francisco and kind of rebirthed at the Castro Theater, to bring it back to the topic.
Do you remember your first trip to the Castro?
Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, my freshman year at the Ruth Asawa School of the Arts. I was 14 years old, and it was, I think, the special premiere of the recut of A Touch of Evil that was done according to Orson Welles' handwritten memo that he sent to the studio. I walked into that theater, and zing went the strings of my heart. I fully became, I think, a San Franciscan that day, and I knew that I was home, you know?
That's beautiful. I mean, what a movie to start with, although I figure, like, Orson Welles and Alfred Hitchcock and some kind of sing-along, there's a pretty good chance that that's where most people start.
Yeah, it's a great film, and what I remember so distinctly from that first screening that I attended at the Castro was that when Orson Welles actually entered the movie as his character, Detective Vargas, I think, the entire audience broke out into applause. I was 14 years old and thought, what is this, like a play? Like, people applaud in movies here? I had found my tribe. And not only did they applaud, but looking around, it was a group of queers, mostly queers and cinephiles, people that I would have actually cast in a film to play people that were hardcore moviegoers. Black turtlenecks, horn-rimmed glasses, people that you could just tell took movies so seriously, that were real connoisseurs of it, not just as entertainment, but as an art form.
And you're working on a story about the reaction among the LGBT community. Can you give us a sneak peek at what you're hearing?
There are a lot of very strong feelings about how a change in that venue will impact not only the neighborhood, but the wider LGBTQ community that comes to the neighborhood for events there. I think there's a real concern that they will be priced out of being able to do special events like the Peaches Christ drag pre-show screenings, like some of the significant community events that have involved the queer community, like Mark Eustace's kind of legendary screenings that he would do where he would bring Golden Age stars to do interviews on stage and then show one of their classic films. There's a lot of concern that that venue could be de-queered, as many spaces have been in San Francisco in the last decade especially. I'm thinking, you know, especially about the Lex, the lesbian bar that was shut down a few years ago in the Mission, and also the late and great Stud in Soma, the Stud Bar. To lose the Castro would be a gaping wound in that neighborhood and in the hearts of many people that have called it their home away from home.
And as both a reporter and a fan of the Castro, as a patron, what was your initial reaction when you heard the news?
I was startled by the idea that it would not be a repertory movie house anymore. There's been a long tradition of live events there, live events before film screenings, comedy shows, drag shows. I actually even directed a musical performance there with the Ruth Asawa School of the Arts of Benjamin Britten's Guide to the Young Person's, A Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. So it's not as though live entertainment is unheard of in that venue. The idea that film would not be an essential part of their programming other than film festivals, though, was absolutely shocking to me. Because what's great about the Castro is not just the special events. It was the idea that one night you could go see a great kind of classic Hollywood double feature, you know, maybe a Joan Crawford movie followed by a Bette Davis movie. Although, as any classic film fan knows, those two women hated each other. And then the next night you could go see La Dolce Vita or some great experimental Benwell film or a film by a new filmmaker that was up and coming that might eventually make an appearance at an SF film special premiere there in a couple of years once they had been a little bit more discovered. The Castro was a place of discovery for so many of us, not only people that got their classic and art house film educations, but it was a place where we found new filmmakers, where we were introduced to new stars. And as a columnist and a reporter, it's also a place where my career has kind of happened over the last decade. I've done a lot of really memorable interviews there, ranging from people like Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone on one hand for a La La Land screening, to Kim Novak herself, you know, the star of Vertigo, the best film of all time, with apologies to Orson Welles and Citizen Kane.
And you told us you took your grandmother to meet her?
In all my years of being a reporter, my grandmother has never once asked to go to any of the fancy things that I get to go to or the special events. You know, she's never had interest in going to the opening night of the opera or even necessarily getting to go to like some big musical production coming in from New York. She called me when she saw in Datebook that Kim Novak was coming to the Castro for a Mark Eustace special screening of Vertigo. And she was very hesitant. She said, okay, well, I don't really want to bother you, but Grandma, you're 90 years old. You couldn't possibly bother me. At 90, you get to call your grandchild whenever you want. She said, but can I love Kim Novak. You know, we're the same generation. Can I go? And I said, yeah, absolutely. I'll send a car to pick you up. We will make it a date. And it is the thrill of my grandmother's life that Kim Novak sat right behind us during the screening. And
you had better seats than Kim Novak?
Kim Novak, I think, wanted to be close to the door so she could make a quick exit there to do the meet and greet afterwards. We were almost in the back row of the theater. Kim Novak was in the very back row with her husband and her manager. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother would lean into me and she'd say every couple seconds, Kim Novak's getting popcorn. Kim Novak just whispered to her manager, like, Kim, are you following this? Like, you should take notes on this. You know, thank you, Grandma. I appreciate your help reporting the story. And then, you know, a thrill of both of our lives. I interviewed Kim before the screening, and then I was able to take my grandmother to meet Kim Novak in the balcony lobby upstairs after the screening, and she said to Kim, you know, movies really were better when you were making them. And and Kim very graciously agreed with her. And for months after that, I got a picture of my grandmother and I with Kim. My grandmother would very casually pull out of her purse when she was seeing friends. Oh, look what I happen to have here. It's a picture of me and Kim Novak. You know, she agrees with me that movies were better before 1965. You know, we're very close friends.
What's your grandmother's name? We should give her a shout out on Total SF.
Evelyn. Grandma Evelyn.
Hi, Evelyn.
Well, I love this. We're going to get back to sharing just some of our favorite memories of the Castro. I thought that would be fun. They're all different for me. But I wanted to dig into the archive as I do and just read the Chronicle's coverage on the day that the Castro opened, which was in June 1922. So the 100th anniversary is coming up. Just digging through the history, this was a neighborhood theater from the beginning. Eureka Valley, as it was called back then, and that's actually where my mom and my grandparents lived. This was a transformation for that neighborhood. I'll read our story just about what was going on in that part of the city. With excellent transportation systems established and assurance of the fine station at the entrance of the Twin Peaks Tunnel as a monument to the tremendous engineering accomplishment, Eureka Valley has become a veritable city itself. In addition to numerous stores distributing every variety of merchandise, Eureka Valley has a bank, the finest steam laundry on the continent, and with the opening of the Castro Theater tonight, we'll have its own amusement center. And I think about it, it was a neighborhood theater serving the neighborhood. The very first movie was like a racing picture, and then there were matinees. They'd have four different movies a week in the beginning so the kids could go there. And I was driving to the 49er game with my mom, you know, one of the Niner games we went to last year, and most of the drive down to Santa Clara, we were just talking about the Castro and how much of a part of her life it was on the weekends, going down there with her cousins and friends and seeing the features, because it served that neighborhood, which at that time there were a lot of children there. The neighborhood changes, and we have Frameline. We have a documentary for the Cockettes is going to open there. Last Black Man in San Francisco, Sketchfest becomes part of that. And that's the thing that I was concerned about when I got the news. Another Planet Entertainment is local. They have a good history with places like Bill Graham Civic Auditorium and with the Fox Theater in Oakland, communicating with the community and taking their cares into account. But the Castro has always been, for 100 years, a theater for that neighborhood. And that's my concern. I'm really going to be looking closely when the first calendars and first announcements come out to see what kind of programming are going to be there and if it reflects that neighborhood and that community.
Yeah, I think that one of the big concerns is with the renovation. That is a historic Timothy Pfluger designed building. Timothy Pfluger is a very significant architect, mostly known for the Art Deco style in San Francisco and California. There were talks about perhaps expanding the lobby. There are certainly upgrades that I think the community will welcome to the electrical system and perhaps to the sound system and expanding the very limited backstage. But I think we've seen a lot of updates or restorations of historic buildings that maybe haven't been done with the level of care and attention to detail that the community would like. And I hope that another Planet Entertainment is in touch with the historical community here and will abide by whatever the standards of preservation there are for that space. Speaking of sort of what first screened there, you know, for anyone that's gone down to the men's room in the basement and seen...
I have not.
I didn't think so, Heather. But seen the posters that line the walls, I believe there is actually a program from pretty early on advertising what the bill was. And among the pictures that I think are mentioned is an early Valentino silent film. So to know that that theater has seen not only so much history in the neighborhood, but so much of the history of cinema, from silence to the birth of sound to, you know, the expansion of screens with technologies like Cinerama to the kind of golden age of Technicolor in the 40s and the 50s. It's seen so much. And I would hate to think that those walls might not be the same as they once were, you know, after having witnessed so much incredible history.
The organ was there from the beginning. I'm reading about the description of the organ with, you know, one pipe so big a man could crawl in it and one pipe so small it's, you know, the size of a needle. And that's a tradition that's held through. I really wish in the announcement they had just said, the organ's coming back. You know, I mean, there were a few things that I think have kind of trickled out that I wish we had heard right off the bat, because there are parts of that theater that if you take it away, it's not the Castro Theater.
And there's been a pretty significant fundraising campaign over the last couple of years to put in a new organ, because I believe the previous one was on loan, that will keep that tradition going at the theater. I think you're absolutely right. Getting to hear them play San Francisco right before the speaker or right before the feature starts and having people clap along at the end, that's just part of the magic of that experience there.
We'll be right back after this short break. Well, I thought we could share a few of just our favorite memories at the Castro. And I wanted to start with you, Heather. You've lived in the city for 20 plus years, and I know you love going there. You have two young boys now, and that becomes part of it. What do you think about when you think of the Castro Theater? What's a memory that jumps out for you?
I mostly associate it with the sing-alongs that have become so popular. I've been to a few of those there. I most vividly remember going to see Sound of Music there and standing in line, and there was a group of people dressed as nuns. One of them was Sister Margarita with a huge margarita glass around her nun's habit, and that's just like so classically San Francisco that nobody even like really glanced at her, but I was like, oh, love it. And then going inside, and it's just such a party atmosphere and getting the favors, party favors, and all singing along together, and it was just such an event. It was so much more than just watching a movie. I also remember, funny enough, one of my most vivid memories was a time I didn't go because my sister volunteered to watch my kids so my husband and I could go on a day date. And what she ended up doing with my boys and their cousins was taking them to a Moana sing-along at the Castro Theater. And when I heard about that, I was like so jealous. And I was like, wait, why did I go on a date with my husband? We should have gone there. So my boys loved it. And it's just always been such a fun, happy place to be.
I'm so glad you mentioned the sing-alongs and the Sound of Music. Laurie Bushman and Sarah Moore, who have run those sing-alongs for many years, I think do an incredible job of taking kind of the wild spirit of the community there and making it very family friendly, but not in a way that is cloying or too saturine. I love the little gift bags, especially that they give for audience participation. So it's like taking all the fun of Rocky Horror and making it something you can bring your children to.
Totally.
Although in this city, I think people do bring kids to Rocky Horror, and I approve.
Probably.
I think about Godfather 1 and 2, which I took my older son Theo to it, and I went with my aunts, Susan Leal and Susan Hirsch, and we're all going there. He's a little young, like 13. I'm like, is this even appropriate? Is he going to get bored? We're going to sit through these two movies. And I remember after the first movie, which he was just locked in on, he wanted to know when the intermission was, so that he could like time his bathroom breaks. I mean, he was so into it. And then on the way home, we're, I think, on BART, and he's on Wikipedia and just going through and telling me little facts about Godfather 1 and 2. I mean, it's like 13 years old. I didn't know he had really fallen in love with movies yet. And he's drilling into Godfather in a way that that reminded me of me. And also made me so excited that I had taken him to see it at a theater. It would have been such a different experience if I had done it at home. And I think that's a foundational memory for him. And I just think about all of the foundational memories like that. I fell in love with theaters when my parents dropped me off at the Arlington in Santa Barbara. And I remember the theater as much as I remember Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is a great movie. I remember how it felt sitting there and how I felt independent and, you know, I just think of all the people who've had that experience that, you know, if this isn't in some form a repertory film house, I think we're missing a lot.
Mm-hmm. Peter, were you around for the 25th anniversary celebration of The Godfather at the Castro Theater?
I was not. Were you there?
No, I've heard incredible stories about it, though. People comparing it to what recently happened for the Matrix premiere that was there, saying that they closed down the street, that almost all the cast came, I think, except Marlon Brando, who was still alive, but not doing public appearances at that point. And, you know, this year's the 50th anniversary of The Godfather. I am hoping that people get to see it in the Castro Theater again.
Yeah, that'd be incredible.
That'd be awesome.
You know, one of my favorite LGBTQ memories of the Castro is actually seeing the film Milk there shortly after it opened. To be in the Castro and then to see the Castro as part of several of those scenes, I think including one of the big political demonstrations early on that very prominently features Peaches Christ as one of the drag queens leading the demonstration, right now as I'm talking about it, I feel the hair on the back of my neck standing up. Mm. It was just so special to be reminded that Harvey Milk, that all of the history he represents, happened in my own backyard. I actually lived in Noe Valley just over the hill at that time. And to know that every day I walked in the same steps that he did, and that people like the great Cleve Jones, who is thankfully still with us and such a great resource about the history, you know, reminded me that it is the LGBTQ community. Mm-hmm. And it's such a privilege to be a part of it. And that space is not only a temple to cinema, but really a great community gathering space.
Mm-hmm. The special events, I've been to a few there. I think of the Last Black Man in San Francisco premiere in 2019, which was so difficult to get in. I almost turned around because I didn't have to be there. I wasn't covering anything. And I get in, sit down, and these two filmmakers, Joe Talbot and Jimmy Fails, get up there and express this absolute love for the venue and the city and the filmmaking experience they just had. And then the composer for their film, who is wonderful, Emil Mosseri, I think his name is, and Michael Marshall, who is I Got Five on it. He's been in the rap community, but he sings the song San Francisco. They went up and did this arrangement with tubas and him singing. It is one of the most electric moments I've ever experienced, just as a critic or as a consumer of entertainment. And I'm still high off it. And I immediately thought of that when they made the announcement that, well, those types of events, maybe we won't get less of those. Maybe we'll get more of those. Maybe, you know, with another Planet Entertainment, their connections, maybe we get someone like, you know, Ali Wong coming in and doing a residency there. I mean, I can just think of all these San Francisco connections that could happen there and could still happen even as this venue transforms. Maybe it's wishful thinking, but that's my hope.
And I want to point out that Joe is a alumnus of the Ruth Asawa School of the Arts as well, many years after me.
I just want to say thank you for calling it by the full name. There's so few schools or buildings of any kind named after women, and so many people drop the Ruth Asawa from the name. So
as someone that has reported, you know, whose beat really emphasizes visual art and who has written stories about Ruth Asawa, I think it's ridiculous not to call it by the full name, especially when we have such prominent talks about renaming the high schools. Let's honor the names of women in these schools, certainly, especially women of color that were interned by their own governments during World War II. Okay, lecture over.
I think we can include her full name.
Did you see Ruth Asawa while you were there?
At the high school?
Yeah.
One of my great regrets is that she was not, you know, really included on the teaching staff or somebody that we had regular access to. But you would see Ruth working in the courtyards. I graduated from the school when it was at the Font Street campus, which is now a soccer field next to San Francisco State. And I actually witnessed her several times working on the Japanese internment memorial garden at San Francisco State. So although I did not know her, I think her presence was very felt if you knew where to look.
Well, Tony, we're going to go to the lightning round. You have never experienced the lightning round, and I'm dying to hear your recommendations. But any other thoughts, any other memories about the Castro, anything else you want to share?
In addition to having done, you know, several interviews with big stars at the Castro, I'm also lucky enough to have hosted a couple of things or been involved with onstage talks at the Castro. Most recently, I was part of a Frameline discussion for the Mayor Pete film. But right before that, my first event back on stage at the Castro was the San Francisco in theater premiere of Darcy Drollinger's Shit and Champagne movie. Mm-hmm. Darcy being the owner-operator, star drag queen of Oasis. Mm-hmm. And actually, a few years ago, I did one of the more awkward public events of my life, which was a onstage interview with a very cranky Academy Award nominee, who I will not name.
You have to tell us when we stop recording.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That tea will be served. But, you know, any time you're on stage at the Castro, I think, is a good time. But it was, like, such an awkward event that for months afterwards, people were coming up to me saying, oh, I saw you and XYZ on stage. You know, they weren't very nice to you. That was really awkward. I'm so sorry. And I said, you know, thanks. You know, all in a day's work.
That is unfortunate. But what is fortunate is we get to hear your answers to the lightning round. Where is your favorite place in San Francisco to get a burrito?
I'm actually gluten intolerant, so I can't have burritos. Sorry.
Where is your favorite place in the city to get a stiff drink?
Oh, let's say Twin Peaks Tavern, followed by Oasis and Let's Go Old School here, Big Four on Knob Hill.
Nice.
I like it. It's a progressive party. Yeah. Good one.
What is your favorite movie filmed in San Francisco?
Okay, so this is a tough tie between Vertigo and Peter is going to guess the second one, The Princess Diaries. Third place, What's Up, Doc?
We're going to show What's Up, Doc next in our Total SF movie series.
So that's exciting.
Hopefully you can come to that.
Absolutely. And the late and great Peter Bogdanovich, who recently passed. But I have to give credit to Polly Platt, his wife at the time, who suggested that San Francisco be the location. I think Peter originally thought Chicago would work. Mm. Polly said, no, you got to have those hills. They're made for comedy.
What has changed most since you were a kid in San Francisco?
I would say there is a lot more super wealthy people in San Francisco. It feels like it's becoming a city that has a lot more rich people in it. And I don't know that a city that only rich people can live in is necessarily a good thing. In fact, I would say it is not.
Yes, for sure. What is your favorite San Francisco landmark?
I'm going to pay homage to my visual art beat and say the De Young Museum. I think it's a great new building. Castro Theater, though, for the sake of this podcast, should also get a mention.
What is your favorite San Francisco?
I really like the neighborhood that I live in, Anza Vista, the smallest neighborhood in San Francisco, but also got to tip my hat to the Castro. You know, I came of age as a queer there.
Who is your favorite San Francisco drag queen?
I cannot answer that without enormous professional repercussions.
I knew you were going to say that, but I had to try. If you could wave a magic wand and change one thing about the city, what would it be?
It would be more affordable. I think that a city that artists can live in, that waiters, waitresses, service industry people, people of all economic stripes live in, is a better city.
Yeah. Last question. What is something you always make sure to squeeze into your busy day?
I mean, maybe we can go back to the stiff drink here. That is something that I end a busy day with sometimes. I don't know, a walk out in the neighborhood, you know, experiencing the air, especially this incredible fog we've had the last couple of days. Getting out into the good San Francisco air that blows in from the west is great.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for making time for us.
Yeah, and Tony, I miss you, and I look forward to the future when we can be in a newsroom and just run into each other randomly again, because those were always my favorite conversations with you.
Yeah, among my favorite too, and I'm looking forward to seeing you both at What's Up Doc, and fingers crossed we'll all be back at the Castro again for a movie, some of that antique popcorn, and a cup of the good coffee that you can always smell in the lobby.
Love it.
Excellent.
See you soon.
Thank you, Tony.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the San Francisco Chronicle. Total SF is a production of the Chronicle. Our music is The Tide Will Rise by the Sunset Shipwrecks off their album Community, and Cable Car Bell Ringing by 8-time champion Byron Cobb. Support Total SF in the newsroom that creates it by investing in a digital Chronicle edition. It's less expensive than you think at sfchronicle.com/pod.